We have two of our new member class from last week who were not able to be here last week. Were present this morning. I think they were forced to move a minute ago, maybe by the sunlight, right? But it brought them up a little closer to the front. And I didn't get to tell them this, but I would like for Jim and Joanne Dye to stand just for a second and face you so that you can see who they are. Will you do that for me? We welcome you very warmly into this church. We missed you last week. I read two parables last week within an hour of each other, one of them from the Bible, the other from a weekly magazine. I'd like to start with the second. According to that story, an 18th century king of Prussia goes on an inspection tour of a prison in Berlin. As he walks by the inmates, they all fall on their knees and shout that they have not deserved to be in jail, that they are innocent. But while he is listening to them, he notices one prisoner off in a corner who seems bored by all the noise. "Why are you here?" the king asks. "Armed robbery, Your Majesty." "Were you guilty?" "Oh, yes. I was guilty. I got what I deserved." The king looked at him in disbelief and called the jailer. "Release this guilty man right away. I won't have him kept in this prison where he will corrupt all the innocent people who occupy it." I like the irony, first of all. Everybody else lies. One man tells the truth. And by telling the truth, he gets out, although he deserves to be kept in. And I like the story next because it appeals to a streak of cynicism present in most of us. We are so accustomed to hearing people deny guilt and refuse responsibility that it is amusing to find one who cheerfully admits the justice of his punishment. But most of all, the story sticks for a while in my mind because it disturbs me and makes me reflect on a value everyone says is fundamental. Honesty. Is there more of it or less of it than ever? I don't think there's any doubt about how much we like to find an honest person. We're as pleased as the king was, and perhaps as surprised. The question is whether we really want to be honest, except when it's easy or when it pays. We watch our friends give lip service to honesty, telling their children to be honest. And then we watch some more until we discover that what they really want is for their kids to be shrewd, making use of honesty when it is useful, dropping it when it isn't. We would never call the latter dishonesty, of course. We call it realism, practicality, common sense. And when it is, as it sometimes is, blatant dishonesty, we fool ourselves into thinking it isn't, and we believe, we really believe, we are honest people. I don't want to be naive or dishonest during a talk about honesty. I realize, and I hope this is not a shocking statement, that no one is entirely honest. No one. I doubt that it's possible. Total honesty in social relationships, for example, would probably wreck most of them. So what we have to talk about are degrees of honesty. What are the forms of honesty without which, for example, I cannot claim to be Christian. What deceptions go too far are not allowable, harm other people, harm me. But before we're likely to deal honestly with that question, we probably have to admit we are in danger from our deceptions and need to consider them carefully. I think Groucho Marx had it right. There's only one way to find out if a man is honest. Ask him. If he says yes, you know he's a crook. Well, jokes aside, not necessarily a crook, but at least self-deceived. Like the owner of the appliance store in Kansas City who kept telling his young son day after day how important it was to be honest. One day he came home and said, "Son, I can show you now what I meant about honesty. While my partner Jim was out of town today, one of our oldest customers paid his account with a brand new $100 bill. He was almost out the door when I noticed he had given me $200 bills stuck together. And right away, son, a question of honesty and ethics arose for me. Should I tell my partner when he came back?" We are acrobats in avoiding the truth about who we are and what we do. Experts at rationalization and cover-ups. And the smarter we get, the better we do it. So that a big vocabulary and persuasive rhetorical skills can be effective ways of disguising the truth. Lawyers, professors, ministers are at risk. If you sleep through my sermon, shall I search myself for weaknesses or explain to my colleagues that you are people with no interest in ideas? How honest do I dare be with myself? We hear basketball players talk about the moves another player has. Self-deceivers have moves. Here is George, who does one generous thing in a decade and congratulates himself for 10 years as a philanthropist, believing it on one level because he wants to believe it. Deep down, very deep down, if he has had years to work at it, there is a self that knows better and is uneasy, and that uneasiness will do bad things to George's personality without his understanding why. Here is Jane, who never stops talking about the faults of other people, and why, except to convince herself that she is free from fault, the greatest of all self-deceptions. What the self-deceiver has to avoid at all costs is self-communion. He dare not have honest talks with himself late at night, or he finds out the truth and the facade crumbles. Meanwhile, the inner life gets eaten out like a piece of Swiss cheese full of little holes that get bigger and bigger until the whole inner life is gone, until one has reached the point where he cannot even trust himself. This is a pulpit, and so I am bound to come to Scripture, where there is a famous story of self-deception. It is as lurid as a daytime soap opera, but I shall be circumspect in telling it because it is summer and because the children are present. We have King David, who has a wife or two and dozens of concubines, and we have Bathsheba, who has a single husband but is very beautiful And we have that famous glimpse from the palace roof and David's infatuation. And in a while, we have a very inconvenient pregnancy. David is not overjoyed at the thought of having Bathsheba's husband find out. So he tries to get that man, whose name is Uriah, home on furlough so the baby can be passed off later as his. When that fails, he orders that Uriah be sent into the most dangerous part of the front line of the war, where he'll be sure to get killed. It all happens as David hoped, and he marries Bathsheba. It is a messy little story, but no one seems to feel any discomfort about it until a man named Nathan, a prophet, shows up. One of those people charged with keeping honesty alive. He's not afraid to challenge the king himself. He tells David a parable about two men. One who is very poor and has a pet lamb which eats with his family and is like one of his own children. And another man who is immensely rich with huge flocks and herds. A traveler comes to see the rich man, and when dinner time comes, instead of killing one of his own lambs, the rich man callously takes the poor man's lamb and roasts it with a sprig of parsley in its mouth for his guest. The storyteller stops and waits for David's reaction, which is exactly what he expected. The king is outraged. The man who did that, he says, deserves to die. Nathan says, "You are the man." The point I want from this story is that David had deceived himself about what he had done, and he was not feeling very bad about it. Otherwise, before he got angry at the injustice in the story, he would have realized it was exactly like his own. He would have thought, "Uh-oh, here I am, the king, with a whole harem of the choicest beauties in the land, all belonging to me, and here is this private soldier fighting for his country who has only one wife who means everything to him, and oh boy, I don't want to hear the rest of this." But he had built his defenses so well that Nathan was able to finish and then point his finger before David caught on. But he did catch on, and for the first time he said, "I have done wrong." And the confrontation with himself began. If Nathan had not come at him obliquely, so that David indicted himself before he realized what he was doing, perhaps no one would ever have made him deal with that problem, and it would have festered in him ruinously. So the title of the sermon says, "Everybody needs a Nathan." Some friend of truth who won't let us enjoy our self-deceptions when they are truly dangerous to us. I'm not a believer that people should run around stripping away all the illusions from every life. I happen to think some illusion is essential to us, that we cannot live without it. But there are others so large and damaging we cannot live with them. And we need a Nathan who will make us see that. I saw that violent film about Al Capone recently. And in the film, at least, he seemed completely self-deceived. He liked to talk about what a good citizen he was, how he wanted no trouble with anybody, how his mixing socially with some of the city of Chicago's most prominent people proved his worth. There was a scene of Al at the opera, weeping copiously over the fictional sorrows of a singer, while his hired assassins at that very moment were out gunning down his opponents, who of course had wives and children, but over whom it did not occur to him to grieve. He actually thought of himself as soft-hearted, a man who killed only when forced to do so by stubborn opposition. When he was convicted, at last, he was led out of the courtroom shouting, "Where is justice?" Convinced that he should have been acquitted. But then who would have dared be a Nathan to Al Capone? So how could he find out the truth about himself? Have you ever caught yourself in the very act of being self-deceived about your character, your motives, just because it felt so good to pretend something that wasn't really so? I mean, shaking your head in righteous indignation about a tax cheat when you knew you had done the same? Condemning another woman's indiscretions that had just been made sadly public when you had fallen yourself or been sorely tempted, so that the pose of moral aristocrat was not very appropriate? I don't want to go through a long list like that, so I'll let myself stand for the rest of you and recall a moment of self-deception and self-righteousness from my own life, because I think it will be instructive. I was 14 or 15, and I had a buddy who was the same age, and we had all the predictable hormonal disturbances you would expect for teenage boys. We were not, in today's euphemism, active, but that was only because our parents and our church had built a high wall around our instincts. One Wednesday night at the midweek Bible study, we heard about a scandal in our church. It seemed that one of the deacons had taken it upon himself to teach a private sex education class to some of the very teenage girls we had been dreaming about. The deacon used the blackboard to illustrate anatomy and talked about hormonal changes and how the body blossomed under them, and then, carried away by his work, laid hands upon his students in a fashion distinctly non-biblical, a mode of instruction he continued until one of them told her parents. Now, what is relevant to this particular sermon is the reaction to this revelation by myself and my friend. A great surge of righteous indignation rose up in us, and the thought filled our heads that we should, on behalf of God and in defense of purity, go administer to poor Walter the deacon a good beating. I can still recall how delicious it felt to be so morally superior. How exciting it was to think of myself as God's agent of punishment. But it didn't last very long, because a Nathan came along and pulled the plug on my warm bath of self-deception. The minister of our church, a wise old man, had overheard our rapture at the thought of rebuking Walter, and he sat us down to talk to us about it. He asked, much to our discomfort, if we had ever thought of holding a class like Walter's and had given it up because we hadn't nerve or feared the consequences. He forced us to face the truth that most of our indignation spiraled upward, not from great moral purity, but from a deep and concentrated little bundle of envy. And as he talked, we agreed together that most of our self-righteous posturing had been no more than that, was dishonest and self-righteous and unworthy. Now I have a question for you. Have you identified with me? Are you remembering a time last year or last night when you managed to deceive yourself about your motives and your feelings? If you have, the sermon has reached a level of discomfort which should not be prolonged. If once or twice you had a Nathan to make yourself see yourself, you are among the fortunate.